Hey, what's going on? Mikey Nelson here from ExtremeHumanPerformance.com. A little bit of a frog in my throat, so I sound a little off, but on the phone today with professional strongman and grip expert, Mr. Adam T. Glass. Say hi, Adam.
Hey, what's going on, guys?
We thought it'd be cool to talk today about some of the, or I guess you could say physical culturists or old-time strongmen, and just some of the stuff and exercises that they did and how it relates to people's training nowadays. I mean, I don't think that there's probably really any quote-unquote new exercises, but there's probably a lot of stuff that the average person in a gym hasn't really seen before that, you know, could be highly, highy effective too. So for people who don't know who you are, you want to introduce yourself there, Adam, in case people are living in a cave and never heard from you before?
Yeah, I run AdamTGlass.com as well as GripAndRip.com. Competitive grip athlete as well as a professional performing strongman. Right now holding a world record for the 2-inch vertical bar lift as well as some bending endurance type feats and things like that. Been doing grip training now for 10 years. Doing demonstrations and shows for 3.5 and competition over the last year, as well as being a kettlebell instructor. I've done a lot of work of corrective exercise in the past, and now being primarily focused on biomechanics instead of any particular system of training, just looking at how the body moves and how it can move better.
Nice. What are some typical things you would do in a show, since this is an audio format, you can't really run any video, just to give an idea of what are some, like if you're doing a performing show, what would be some typical things that you would do?
So the big thing is whenever you're doing a demonstration is you have to meet the audience where they're at. So things that you've seen in the past people do, they'll come out and they'll lift different poundages and weights. I don't think that's particularly exciting. So one of the primary ways that I was taught to do shows coming from Dennis Rogers and guys like Slim the Hammerman and the Mighty Adam before that was object destruction. So every person out there has held a wrench in their hand, an 8-inch crescent wrench. They have an idea of the weight, how hard the steel is. So I'll come out with something like a craftsman wrench and either snap it in half or bend it into a U, taking draft horseshoes, twisting them out into S's or into hearts, picking up big weights with a finger. Some of the things I've done in presentations have been 500 pounds with my middle finger, 250 with my pinky, bending all kinds of different steel objects, different tools, lifting up people, all kinds of different things, tearing decks of cards and phone books, which is one that everybody enjoys because everyone's held a phone book or they've held. Most of the feats are centered hand and arm strength, which is one of the key things. Is there's a lot of guys out there who probably have the upper body strength to do some of the things that I do, but they don't have the lower arm strength. And it's just like having really, really crappy balled-out tires on a high-performance car. You got all that horsepower going through the engine into the tires, but the tires just spin and spin and spin because they can't grip the road.
Cool.
And that's kind of one of the things as we get talking about kind of the old-timers. Grip training was really one of the fundamental things for them. But at the time, and I'll cover why in a little bit, they weren't necessarily focused on grip training. It was more out of necessity. So when we talk about kind of the differences between then and today, I'm going to talk about why that was particularly important then.
Cool. So do you want to just maybe fill us in on some of the history? Because there's a lot of people probably listening to the call who, you know, they've probably seen, you know, maybe some old pictures of, you know, Reg Park or some of the older guys who've been around for a while, but they may have never heard of more like Slim the Hammerman or some more of the, I don't really want to say obscure, but, you know, if you go back in history, like these people were actually entertaining, you know, crowds as sort of a, I don't really want to say a circus act, but kind of a vaudeville, you know, type entertainment. You want to fill us in a little bit on the background?
And I'll give, you know, it's kind of one of the things that's died out in America, and there's some people that are working to bring it back, but I'll give you an example. When the Adam and the Slim performed at Madison Square Garden in the 70s, there was 50,000 people there.
Wow, 50,000?
I mean, it was like packed to capacity.
Wow.
And there were some performances that some of these other guys have done, where it was absolutely, it was the sold-out event of the day. You know, right. It's like boxing. Boxing has been on a decline for the last 20 years. And being replaced by MMA, so it's one thing if one thing goes, another thing comes up. But there's been nothing that has really come up that's replaced the performing angle. You know, people just don't really give a shit about powerlifting. They don't really give a shit about World's Strongest Man competition. You know, I look at it, it's a pretty simple metric. If you and the family and the kids are all sitting around and it's a Friday evening and you're deciding where you're going to go, it would be a hard sell to get somebody to agree to take their family to a powerlifting meet. And it's not that I'm dogging out actual powerlifting competitors and their performance, but in terms of watching their sport, it's not interesting. It's not. So
well, it's nothing you can relate to.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. Is people just can't, especially nowadays, the guys are so fucking strong. You know, people can't relate to a 1,000-pound squat. You can't. So it's completely lost in translation. You know, some of the old timers were really the premier entertainers at their time where they were at. Some of the circuses, their strongman show used to be one of the headlining events they would have. You know, nowadays, there's a lot of circuses that still have that presentation, but it's just been eclipsed by how fantastic some other performances have been. You know, I mean, you'd be pretty hard-pressed if you were a performing strongman to top a presentation, something like, you know, Cirque du Soleil.
Yeah.
Which is both very, very artistic, entertaining, but also has some very incredible feats of body coordination and strength.
Yeah, and I think there's something to that. I always have thought in the back of my head that I think people on some level want to see something like this, but they don't know it exists. And so, like, when the Cirque du Soleil came out and they had a more of a traveling show outside of Vegas and stuff, and, you know, I've gone a couple times, and it's amazing because they're doing acts that people can kind of relate to. You know, guys balancing on their hands, their legs way up in the air, and acrobatics, and guys running up poles, and all this stuff. They're not, you know, out there trying to deadlift, you know, 500, 600, 700, 800 pounds, whatever. There's something about using their body and moving it through space, because everyone has sort of a body that can kind of move around, and they kind of know the limitations of what it is. But to see someone else do things that you thought were pretty much impossible, like I saw, you know, guys running up poles just using their feet and hands, and basically doing sort of the skinny man on the windy day, right? They're actually walking down the pole, only using their hands, their bodies like completely straight out. When you see things like that, it's kind of like, wow. And what you're saying, like bending a wrench or things like that, that people can relate to, it's like, oh my gosh, that is kind of crazy, you know?
You know, it's
but interesting
it
the performance, a dying art.
On the performing angle, and this is true of many of the top performing strongmen, I know almost all of the best guys in the world right now, and we all have agreed on something, is that you're never actually showing people what you're strongest at, because most of the time, what really would make you, you know, when we use the word world class, you know, one of the best in the world at something, it's probably not one of your performing feats. I'll give you a couple examples from a couple of the top guys in the world, too. So Dennis Rodgers is unquestionably the guy who's done the most. Dennis has been seen by the most amount of people. He's been on the most television shows. Dennis makes the most money per show. And, I mean, just Dennis is the real deal. So at 168 pounds, Dennis could grab a 120-pound dumbbell right now and curl it with one arm. I mean, that
wow.
is absolutely fantastic strength. But Dennis doesn't do that in shows anymore. You know, he may come out and do something else that requires a tremendous amount of arm strength. But even, and Dennis has done some things that no one else has ever done, but even those things don't represent his limit strength at all. In fact, what Dennis does in a show right now, there's not too many guys that could replicate it. I mean, you know, some of us can replicate portions, but to do the entire show, not so much. And it's not even taxing him, I'd say not even close to his 60%.
Wow.
You know, Mike Bruce, a good friend of mine, Mike can rack pull from the knee, oh God, somewhere around 1,500 pounds at a body weight of about 197.
Oh my
but
gosh.
The same thing. I mean, imagine the amount of logistical trouble you would have setting that up to bring that much resistance and load it up. So, you know, he does some things with a special bar where he actually picks up people. And it looks really cool, but once again, it's nowhere near his max capacity.
Yeah.
For me, some of the things I can do are more impressive to the other strongman, just because if you see me bend a nail, well, then it's kind of the same thing as seeing me bend a piece of steel, so it doesn't matter if it's a 60-penny nail or if it's a 3/8 piece of stainless steel. For most people, because they don't understand exactly how much power it takes, they can't tell the difference between something that's effortless for me and something that takes everything I got.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of got to meet people right in the middle. So the hand balancing thing is something that used to be very, very popular. And I'm not the best historian of everything, but I know that guys can check out Logan Christopher's site, and he has a lot of the history of it.
Yeah.
We'll jump onto it, too, because I want to talk about kind of the differences and why the way people used to train is kind of closer to how performers are doing it nowadays and why it's all been lost. Prior to the 20th century, the only real physical training that you had anywhere in the world was the military and then sports like boxing and wrestling. The majority of other sports, the way that people got into them was more of an attrition-based thing. So you would come out to play, you know, soccer or football for the rest of the world with your buddies, and if you were good enough to keep playing if getting hurt, well, then you'd carry on, and maybe if you played enough games, you'd get to be really good. But they didn't have any type of sports training like we have nowadays. And the majority of physical readiness was primarily a product of military training, which, once again, was mostly an attrition-based thing. And the first people to really pioneer a lot of strength training was primarily wrestlers and boxers. And if you read back at books, you know, you can see all these misconceptions about, you know, for wrestlers, it would be okay for them to swing 50-pound loaded maces, which is pretty damn incredible, but they would tell them, don't lift barbells. So nobody really got it at the time. The circus strongmen may have been some of the only people that were on the road going around that were showing different methods of training. In the Mighty Adams book, he details that the Adam was, he was abandoned. He kind of ran away, but he got picked up by a Russian circus strongman when he was very young. Being a Jew in Europe, he wasn't particularly treated very well, and one night he got really the shit kicked out of him by a guy. And this strongman had found out about it and kind of had a bit of a revenge on the guy who beat him up as a kid and then took him under his wing. And they talk about his training methods that he used growing up working under this guy. And it's kind of that, you know, everything from Russia has got this kind of esoteric bullshit about it. But there are some pretty solid understand today to be foundation of modern training. So for a long time, there wasn't too many things. Some weightlifting techniques started to pick up, and that'll get into the first big difference. So the primary difference you had back then versus now was equipment. It was a logistical problem. They didn't have plate-loaded dumbbells for the most part. A lot of them were cast, where they were just lumping weights on. So gym sets were extremely hard to come by, and a lot of these guys would end up with dumbbell sets, and it's kind of like how people train with kettlebells today. You have one that's too light. You have one you can kind of work with. So you're using a lot of different techniques to get the most mileage out of a given piece of equipment.
Yeah, because they didn't have, like, you know, 30, 35, 40, 45. I mean, I think wasn't there dumps like closer to 10, 20, 30 pounds sometimes?
I mean, and you got to remember, these were all pieces of equipment that were primarily made by hand. So it was very, very expensive.
Oh, yeah.
A given lifter might have had a couple of lighter weights, and I can't even speculate on the poundages, but what we know is that most of them were probably being 20 and 50 pounds. And then a lot of them had a heavier set of weights, and then they would usually have a challenge weight that they would have custom made once they hit a point. You know, and it's the same thing. If you work on picking something up long enough, you will get there.
Yeah.
So there wasn't a lot of gyms. You had athletic centers in some of the bigger cities, but for most people, the only way they could train was a combination of body weight, odd objects, and whenever they could get their hands on resistance. And as it became more popular, you know, some types of weights became more available. So the first thing we see is a lot more one-handed lifting, which is what we don't see much of at all in a commercial gym. So instead of working with an evenly loaded barbell, most of these guys were doing a lot of one-handed deadlifting, one-handed swings, one-handed cleans, one-handed pressing. Going into the same equipment problem, you didn't have squat racks, you didn't have leg presses. Bench pressing never really caught on until somewhere in the 40s or 50s. So there wasn't a lot of guys that had access to that. So they had some other exercises they did on the floor, but it wasn't nearly as popular. The degree of gymnastics training that was present was much, much higher. There's a lot of misconceptions and myths on how strong some of these guys were, and I think a lot of it is a bit of bullshit. But we do know that a lot of these guys were far, far more athletic than most other people because they had a more diverse background in their training. So what we see today is we see people that are far more specialized and demonstrate superior power and limited range of movements, but we don't see a lot of athleticism. You know, nowadays, a guy who bench presses 400 pounds and squats 600, he typically doesn't move very well.
Yeah.
But we're not seeing that. We're not seeing a lot of guys that could go do, walk around on their hands, maybe do some work on a set of parallel rings, go and do, a long bike ride or a long swim, or, you know, wrestling was such a popular sport. One of the metrics they'd have is how long a given guy could go wrestle.
Mm.
You know, Sandow, the Atom, Hack, all those guys would go wrestle for hours at a time. And these were documented as, you know, as official as things could have been there. But some of these guys were going to wrestling tournaments and they would wrestle, you know, 15 guys in a single day.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, very, very big difference from nowadays where, you know, I look at it like some of the MMA models where the guys are prepping for 12 weeks for a single fight. And even that's been a big shift from even 15 years ago where UFC used to be a tournament setup.
Yeah.
You know, a guy could go to UFC and have to fight three fights in one night. And I'm not saying it's worse or anything like that. I'm just saying it's different. So the logistics of training made it to where people had to train differently. They had to use a wider variety of methods. There was a lot more one-handed lifting. And there was a lot more training with more of odd objects. You know, one of the manufacturers...
You define as an odd object for people who may haven't heard of that. What are some of the common things that they use for odd objects?
First, we'll talk about, you know, a simple definition to work with is this. We'll call an odd object anything that's not evenly balanced and loaded. So when you're picking it up, it has an unusual feel to it. So nowadays, your precision-made dumbbells and some of these precision-made barbell sets, they're accurately loaded left to right within ounces.
Yeah, especially for competitions. For example, I did a powerlifting meet, and the weight sets all have to be, like, completely standardized and certified and individually weighed and all that kind of stuff.
Yes, yeah, and there's very, very low tolerance for variation.
Yep.
And then on the same token, I have an original York dumbbell blob, which is half of a York, and it's half of a 100-pound dumbbell, and it weighs 54 pounds.
That's only the one side of it.
Yeah, that was one side of it. And maybe the other side weighed 42 pounds, or maybe the other side weighed 58 pounds. Is probably all over the map, you know, because the manufacturing standards were very, very different. So for everyone who's listening, a simple definition of an odd object is something that is outside of spec toward be loaded. So things that the guys used to use was one of them was dumbbells. Now, I talked about grip training earlier, and I'll come back to it. Because of the way they were manufacturing, a lot of times they had to go off a much thicker handle or a shaft on the weight. And there was no standardization. You know, nowadays, either 1 1/16 or 1 1/8 is kind of the standard for most barbells. There's a couple that are slightly thicker, but they're all pretty much the same. If you go to 100 gyms right now, you're probably going to see all the barbells within very small tolerance.
Yeah, I think they're all right around 1 inch.
Yeah, they're all right around the same.
Yeah.
Back then, they didn't have that. So they had, you know, they weren't all made from steel or iron. They were made from different types of metals at different standards. So sometimes the easiest way for a manufacturer to make sure it was a safe lifting implement was to make a handle thicker.
Oh,
so you'll see some old dumbbells, old barbells that have some pretty stout handles on them. And that was simply structural limitation at the time. So you either had to be strong enough to hang on to it and work with it or you weren't. You know, additionally, the requirements of using things like heavy clubs, heavy maces, that would require much, much stronger hands. Keg lifting, anvil lifting, some of them were more of stunts or kind of competition events that guys would get into, but a lot of them took it pretty seriously. The Kettlebell training used to be a lot more popular both in this country and in Europe. The kettlebell training, I think, back then was completely different with what is called kind of the legitimate kettlebell training or kettlebell sport, which is primarily the snatch and jerk for repetitions. There was a time where it was more of either an all-around strength technique or for different demonstrations. Juggling was very popular. Most of the old books where they refer to kettlebells, they specifically talk about juggling them.
When you say juggling, you're just talking about, for people who aren't familiar, just moving the kettlebell through space and then throwing it sort of with one hand and catching it with the other. So you're not necessarily holding on and doing, like, exercises like we see pretty much everybody doing now. You're literally throwing the weight through space in different orientations and catching it with the other hand.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun for guys.
Very, very fun.
It's one of those things where you can kill 30 minutes throwing around a 40-pound piece of iron and not even realize it's going by. It's a good time.
Yeah. Continue.
So that was one of the big things then. And if you look at how competitions were graded back then, it was happening differently around the world, but there were some common things. One of the things that was very interesting was kind of where bodybuilding started at. So where bodybuilding started at was actually an athletic competition. Guys would come out, and they would have to do different things. It might have been a clean and jerk. It might have been a press. It might have been some type of deadlift or some type of pickup of weight. There would be almost like a gymnastics floor routine of different hand balancing and stunts, perhaps some kind of feat of strength or demonstration of strength, and then they were awarded physique points on top of all that.
I almost sort of think of it as kind of like a modern-day strongman competition, but you also have to look the part also, and then be able to do some gymnastic stuff too.
I think actually the closest thing to where it started is actually women's fitness routines nowadays, where the women
come out, they
do a routine, and then they're judged on both how they look and how they do things.
Yeah, there's certain required moves they have to do and stuff too.
Yeah, and I think it was a lot like that, and of course, I don't know for certain, but through all the books I've read, it seems to be. And you know what that tells us is, number one, being the strongest guy there didn't guarantee a win, but nor did being the best-looking guy.
Yeah.
And both sports started to change afterwards, because after they changed, it meant that you could go out and just find the biggest damn mastodon you could who could lift the most weight. or you could show up and just have been the best dieted guy, and you may not have been very strong at all, not related to the competition.
Yeah.
Another common trend that we see is the majority of the people that we kind of refer to as the old-timers, almost all of them had started with a background of kind of the classic weightlifting. So nearly all of them were at least competent in clean, snatch, jerk, press.
Convert almost Olympic weightlifting-ish.
Yes, and back then, of course, the technique was not nearly as, you know, nowadays, yeah. I mean, it's a true science. It is a precision sport.
Yeah.
There's so many things going on with it, but back then it wasn't quite the same, but all the guys were doing things like that, which I think, you know, I mean, ripping a weight off the floor at overhead builds a type of strength that's hard to build with other ways.
And yeah, especially the speed it takes to perform that.
Oh, absolutely.
And do a snatch ball.
What killed weightlifting was dropping the press and not picking up the bench press. And I think that's probably, the bench press is probably what let powerlifting take off.
That's probably true, yeah. I mean, because that's, if I'm trying to think back, and I'm not the world's best historian on powerlifting at all, but I think the bench press, in terms of the three power lifts, I mean, other than deadlifting, which it had been already kind of sort of around, but I think that was probably one of the bigger contested lifts, wasn't it? I could be wrong on that.
It's one of those things, I think, for most people, it's just, God, there'd be so many people that get mad at me when they hear me say this, but out of the three power lifts, it's not the most technical of the three. You know, the squat is infinitely more technical than the bench press, and a bench press is extremely primitive compared to what it takes to do a snatch or a jerk. So
that's true. I would agree with that.
It's more of a lift that kind of any man or woman can get into, and between removing the press, which was a strict strength event, not necessarily based on speed or technique, and then a new sport popping up that had an easier lift to get into, I think it killed it.
And the press you're saying is just a standing overhead military press would be kind of considerate nowadays.
Yep, picking up a weight to shoulder and then putting it overhead using pretty much arm and shoulder strength.
Yeah.
One of the other things that was pretty substantial with a lot of the old-timers was the diversity of different attributes they were pursuing, but they also kind of understood that you had to stay limited as far as what you were doing to get there. And I know that's kind of a cloudy statement, but you had guys that were going out and they were pursuing multiple sports at one time. So you'd have guys that would do, in a single year, they may do a weightlifting exhibition, they may have done a wrestling or boxing match, they may have done foot races, they may have done physique competition, they may have done a general demonstration. And they kind of had an idea of what was working for them, which, like I said, going back to a lot of it was pick up heavy shit, put it overhead, and a lot of one-handed lifting. You know, nowadays people are kind of all over the map. You watch your average person go to the gym, and their plan is they're going to show up, they do 5 to 50 sets of bench press of 135, they curl some dumbbells, they hop on a leg extension for 2 or 3 sets, they might do some lunges or jog on a treadmill for 15 minutes, and then they can't quite figure out why they're not getting the physique they want. You know, or you have people who completely omit leg and back training, and they do hit shoulders, chests, and arms all the time, and they can't figure out why they've been 175 pounds for the last 4 years. I don't know, maybe all that muscle mass that goes unchallenged would have something to do with it.
Yeah. Or even just if you go to most commercial gyms, this may not be necessarily people listening to this call, but, I mean, I've done deadlifts in just a commercial gym, and I haven't done a ton of weight or whatever, but you get close to even doing just 2 times body weight, and people look at you like you're a two-headed space alien, you know, and then picking stuff off the ground, you know, many years ago was just, that's what you did.
Well, you know, modern gym owners aren't doing us a lot of damn favors, and I own a damn gym, so I'm going to tell you this. If you're a gym owner, your job is to provide a facility for people to come train in to get their goals. It's not necessarily to tell people what they have to do or what they can't do. If you have clients who want to lift overhead, then buy a platform and get bumper plates. If you have clients that want to pick up heavy weight, then have a proper deadlifting station. Don't run around. You know, Mike, I think we've talked about this on the calls, too. Did you know that there are gyms that are equipped with seismic alarms that will go off in the event a lifter drops weight on the floor? And it's like a siren goes off to alert gyms that have to kick that lifter off the floor.
How was it, like, the kind of in Florida or somewhere? They called it the lunk alarm. They actually
have an alarm that would go off in the gym.
Is it really?
There is one in Dillon Abbey was at one of them one day.
Oh.
If gyms here in town, it's unbelievable to me.
Oh my God!
You know, I mean, my thing is this: if you own a gym, then you're agreeing that you have some vested interest in getting people better, right? Maybe stronger, leaner, more muscle, whatever. So you should be letting them do the things that they need to get there. And what's amazing to me is people will say, "I don't let people lift overhead in my gym because that's dangerous." But at the exact same time, they'll allow some 14-year-old kid to put 2,000 pounds on a leg press where his lower back is ready to freaking snap.
Yeah.
You know, or they'll have guys in there that are leg pressing until they're having, you know, nosebleeds and they blow out every single blood vessel in their eyeballs. And I'm not saying people can't do that either. If you want to do that, if you want to abuse yourself that way, go for it. But don't tell me that that is safe and deadlifting, you know, 405 is not.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's amazing to me, the other thing is, because I've also seen gyms where they don't allow any overhead lifting whatsoever. I got kicked out of a gym when I was in Mississippi a couple of years ago for doing some one-arm lifting overhead. And the same time we're doing that, there's a group of young men that are next to me. I was in a squat rack using a fun rack for some bent presses. And they're benching, and they're basically letting the bar fall onto the guy.
They
hit him in the sternum. And then the spotter, who's really doing all the work himself, would pull the weight off the guy. I mean, it was pretty brutal looking. And once again, you know, there was no contest to their behavior. And I know this is, if I was an insurance agent and I was walking the gym to determine what the liability and risk is, I would be more concerned about that behavior than I would the guy who was put in, you know, a mere 135 overhead. Big deal.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's even gyms now where they, like the gym I work at during the day part-time, they had to argue, because it's a big fitness chain that goes into corporations, to get a bench press in there that wasn't like a Smith machine type thing. And they had to argue for months and months because they felt it was unsafe. Which, it may be, but at the same point, you can't lift anything heavy off the ground where if anything happens, you just drop it.
You know, and the argument of safety, that's a slippery slope because
yeah.
I guarantee this, if we pool enough people, there's been somebody hurt on every machine ever made.
Oh,
there's been
yeah.
somebody hurt doing every... I guarantee it. I don't know where to look for this, but I guarantee there's been somebody who's been hurt doing kickbacks of a 10-pound dumbbell.
Oh, I'm sure.
So there's yeah. the issue of what is safe and what is dangerous is a slippery slope. What makes more sense to me, though, is educate the people.
Yeah.
On, look, this is probably what's going to get you to go fastest. For most people, it's this call. My opinion is this. Doing more unilaterally loaded lifting, so single limb, single arm, single leg, with a variety of poundages, with the simple focus being picking shit up off the ground and trying to put shit overhead, will make you far stronger than employing circuits of the newest machines in the gym. And there, you know what, there's some machines out there that I really like. I'm a fan of Hammer Strength. I'm a fan of, you know, some of the things they make. Man, they're really cool. They got a really cool grip machine. I like their shoulder pressing machines. I like their bench press machine. I like their deadlift and their trap shrug machine. Hey, great. But I still think that most people do better just doing one-hand lifting, picking up off the ground, putting it overhead in a variety of manners.
Yeah. If you even want to start with two hands, I'd be perfectly fine with that, too. Not saying that it's, you know, better or different. It's just, I think one hand allows you to work a different stimulus, especially comparing left to right. But most people don't even use two hands to pick anything up. So, I agree with you, though.
I think that'd be the first one. The next thing I think that'd be very, very useful for most people is include more body weight training in their program and closer to kind of the gymnastics angle. You know, and I'm not saying that every person needs to go out there and learn how to jump over pommel horses and do an iron cross, but most men, and this is what I've been amazed of, particularly since I've been out of the military, most men can't even do 20 push-ups.
Not good ones.
No, not a true push-up. I'm talking all the way down to the deck, all the way back up. Most people can't even do that. And it seems, I don't know, for some reason it seems like it'd be good common sense that you'd be able to handle your own body weight for 20 push-ups before you're trying to get out there and set some kind of new state bench press record. And
yeah.
There's a lot of guys out there that can't even do a single pull-up. And there's far too many guys that can't
common.
Do a single dip. So it just makes sense to me to try to get on those things right there. You know, body weight training, it can't get a person to all their goals, but for most people, considering the direction they're going in, which is primarily aesthetics with maybe a little bit of functional strength or so-called functional fitness, body weight training would be much higher payoff than, once again, riding the machine circuit or, you know, basically playing these games that people are doing right now.
It's always a kick to the nuts, too. Like, I remember when I first started training, I was typical. I started at 18. I had no idea what the heck I was doing, you know, and you go in and you go, well, you just, you know, do the machines like everybody else, and so I got stronger on the machines, and then did some more research and talked to me. Oh, you should do free weight stuff. Okay, you know, so the first time I go to do a, you know, a bench press, I get flattened. You know, first time I try the freaking body weight squat, I was like, oh my god, this is horrible. Well, I was just, you know, leg pressing 500 pounds. What the heck? You know, so you find that a lot of times the machine training didn't necessarily translate into, you know, lifting or moving a free weight. But as I got stronger with free weights every once in a while, then I'd try a machine, and, oh, I was stronger on the machine. So it was always very interesting that using free weights seems to transfer to more things, where using machine-based stuff, and it has its place, it seems to be a lot more specialized.
You know, it was in, it was in one of Matt Fury's books I read a long time ago. I was a fan of Matt Fury when he put out the whole combat conditioning program.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things he talked about was, you know, he said, let's try an experiment. We're going to take one guy, we're going to put him on a machine-only program, where he's going to do any machine he wants in a gym for as many sets and reps as he wants for 3 months. We're going to take another guy, we're going to put him on a body weight training program, right, where he's going to do all these different body weight movements, different pulls and push-ins and squattings. And then we're going to have him flip at the end of 3 months, and let's see who can do whose workout.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, you show me a guy who can do 20 pull-ups, who can do 50 dips, who can do 100 push-ups, who can do 200 or 300 squats, and then we put him in the weight room on the machines, and he's going to do fairly well for himself. You show me someone who can do leg extensions of 250 pounds, can do the Nautilus fly machine with, you know, 100 pounds on a weight stack, leg press of 700 pounds, that may not translate to very much.
Yeah.
It typically doesn't. You know, and once again, for all the callers, if there's people out there and you train that way, I'm not making fun of you, but what I am saying is that if your goal is strength, and you have an interest in doing much better than where you're at, I'm going to tell you, I just don't believe that machine training is where it's at. You know, until we start seeing guys that are trained strictly on machines do better in the strength sports, it's just hard for me to sign off on it.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. So what are some other exercises that used to be rather routinely performed? I mean, if I remember correctly, there used to be, they had competitions to do a one-handed deadlift, I think, correct?
Yes. In fact, let's go over some of the kind of the lost exercises and things that people can do. Sorry about that, Mike. I got someone trying to call in. I'll get back to them later for that beep.
Oh, that's
okay.
Right.
So one of the I don't want to say lost it, but of all the lost exercises, here's one that you'll probably never ever see someone do intentionally, although they may do it unintentionally. Is what's called the continental clean. So when they talk about continental, what they're talking about was there was a lifting style employed in Britain, and then there was a lifting style employed in the rest of Europe. And the continental clean was cleaning the bar basically in segments. So the lifter may first lift the barbell up to their knee. Then they would bring it up to their waist. And because they're allowed to wear lifting belts, a lot of the guys would set the bar on their waist for a second. And then pull it up to their chest, and then get it up to their neck, and then finally they're in a clean position. So once somebody gets comfortable with a continental style of cleaning, they can typically clean way more weight than they could with the older style clean. Now, nowadays, you know, the Olympic clean is a very, very powerful technique with these guys dropping way under the bar. And I'd imagine the ultimate potential for the clean is far higher today than it used to be. But having to pull a bar up the body sequentially like that would make a person very, very strong. And it also would get them used to dealing with an awkward load and almost having to fight it the whole way up there. So these guys were pretty damn strong to be able to continental clean 300 or 400 pounds all the way up the body to get into position.
Oof.
Now, for people listening to this, if you wanted to learn how to do that, you got to start easy. All right,
oh,
maybe,
yeah.
75, 95 pounds, and just get used to understanding kind of the phases of it. But later on, you can get quite strong. So the next thing was the standing press. You know, and that in itself, everybody seems to understand it when you say military press, but I rarely see anybody doing it. We see a lot of guys doing it.
I totally agree with that.
And everybody says the standing press is bad for your back. But if you notice the back position of most people who are doing seated presses, they're putting their body in more biomechanical jeopardy than standing press. The danger of standing press comes into play when a guy starts to lean back who's not ready for it. And in fact, leaning back on the press would still, it still is a valid technique. There's a video that Jed Johnson and Jim Smith put out in 2005 that was called The Shit You've Never Seen. And I love it. It's these two big, crazy guys lifting in their garage.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Jed is really big on is Jed does almost a standing bench press, where he'll clean a weight, and he leans way back and presses it. And he talks about it. He said, you know, a lot of people would think that would hurt, but for me it feels real good.
Yeah.
So lean back is where we may see danger, but for most people,
a vertical torso position, vertical spine with the overhead press is not any more dangerous than any other particular thing across the generic sample population. There may be people who can't tolerate it.
Sure.
And for those of you out there who shouldn't be doing it, if you have any questions, contact your doctor.
Yeah.
So along with the two-arm press is, of course, one-arm pressing. And when we get to one-arm pressing, we kind of get into another exercise that is very, very long, which was the bent press, also called the screw press. And it's not actually a press. What it is support feet. So a lifter will have the weight in one hand, and they would have their elbow far out to the side, sitting back almost on their hip. And then they would do a sideways lean, and as they would lean away from the weight, their arm would straighten out because it was being held in position on their back. I've got some videos on my site and on my YouTube of me doing it. There's a couple other guys that are pretty good at it. But the bent press allows a lifter to lift a pretty substantial amount of weight with one hand. You know, with the record being a guy who lifted somewhere around 350 pounds with one hand.
Wow.
Huge lift.
Yeah, that one's hard to describe, too. It's almost like you push your body actually underneath the weight instead of pushing the weight overhead. As you can kind of visualize that.
In a proper executed bent press, you never actually press the weight. There's some guys who are doing it very fast where you fall away from it. There's other guys who did it slow where you just bend away from it. But if you can imagine the weight as a static position in space, your body moves under the weight to get it into position versus moving the weight.
Yeah.
One-handed deadlifting and the wide variety of types there were very, very popular. You know, there were different types of straddle deadlifts, different types of the suitcase deadlift, one hand, both conventional and sumo style, all different types of pickups with one weight. And that really is closer to life. And that's one of our goals as companies. We want more people training closer to their life movement.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't make sense that you go to the gym and you lift with this precision deadlift form that is, you know, would get the thumbs up from every powerlifting coach in the world. But then when you're at home working around a garage, you're lifting up a rounded back all day and you can't figure out why your back hurts all the time.
Yeah. And your back's probably never been rounded for quite a while.
Squatting techniques. There are two particulars that you don't see anymore. One of them was a Steinberg-style squat, and that was where the weight was tilted up off the ground. So you'd pick up one side of it and lift it to where the bar was nearly vertical, and you would basically duck underneath it and roll it onto your shoulders to squat.
I haven't tried that one for years.
You know what? I'll tell you why I like it, Mike. If you tell a guy to do a Steinberg squat and the most weight he can get into position is 95 pounds, well, then you're fairly certain that he's not going to screw himself up by getting stuck in a hole somewhere.
That's totally true. You never got it there in the first place.
You know, if the weight's too heavy, the guy can't even get in position to hurt himself. I kind of like that about the Steinberg style squat. The other one was the hack squat, which is holding a weight behind the back, and it's almost a ball of foot squat, or you're on the toes. And a lot of people nowadays, they refuse to squat on their toes in a gym, but every time I go to the supermarket, I see people, men and women, squatting on their toes all the time.
Yeah.
So once again, if we're going to do it in the real world, let's do it in training.
Well, even the Steinbarn lift, correct me if I'm wrong, came about because people didn't have squat racks. If we want to squat, we got to figure out how to get the friggin' weight on our back.
You used to have one of two options. Either A, you had a couple of guys around, and you could have those guys get the weight into position for you.
Yeah.
You could clean the weight, jerk it overhead, and then lower it behind the neck, or you could fall underneath it that way.
Yeah.
I don't know when the first squat racks were put into effect, but I know that I have not seen any photographs of a squat rack that are pre-1940s.
Yeah, I was thinking this. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't it York Dumbbell was kind of the first major company that even started making sort of mass equipment, I guess you could say, that I know of. So maybe sometime around there.
I would hazard a guess that's probably accurate.
Yeah.
A lot of what has become modern kind of feats of strength in the grip realm started off as practices that used to be quite common. A lot of different types of
pinch lifting used to be very, very common.
A pinch lift for people who may not know what that is?
So when I say pinch lift, I mean you're taking your hand and your thumb is going on one side of the object, your fingers on the other, and you're lifting it. And the reason you're able to lift it is by the forceps power of the thumb, the strength of your thumb. You know, a lot of people out there, and some of you listeners call it, you may have never thought about this, that you should be training your thumb to be stronger. And,
yeah.
And real quick, I'll segue into that. When your thumb is stronger, you're more injury resistant. So almost everyone out there has experienced what happens when you jam your thumb. It really sucks. It can be a painful endeavor for several weeks. And most of the time in life, when your grip is limited, you're limited specifically by your thumb. When you find you're unable to do things using your hands, a lot of times it's because the thumb is not strong enough to complete the task. You know, everybody emails me and they're always asking, what is the one thing I can do for my grip right now that will make the biggest difference? And here it is. Do pinch lifting. You know, go to the gym, take two plates, have the plates turned smooth side out, sandwich them together, and just take both hands, put them on top, and deadlift them. And then it's pretty substantial poundage that can be worked up. David Horn, Steve Gardner, Jed Johnson, all those guys pinch upwards to 250 pounds.
Whew.
So you can move some pretty big weight that way. Some other very, very popular things was object destruction. So steel bending, very popular for demonstration. Guys would make a lot of artistic patterns out of bars, and they kind of had their signature bends that they would do. Older style book tearing, card tearing, spike bending, driving nails through objects with their hand. What are some other ones? Here's another one you don't see anymore, even though everyone's seen this piece of equipment. So everyone out there has probably seen a Roman chair. It's the old device. You hook your feet on it.
Oh, yeah.
You sit on the bench, you lean back, and you do sit-ups. And nowadays, nobody in the gym would do a Roman chair sit-up because they're so convinced it's bad for the back.
Yeah.
I have photographs of old lifters who were doing Roman chair sit-ups with a barbell several hundred pounds across the chest.
Wow.
Bridging, spinal extension drills, very, very popular. A lot of people have probably seen an older photo of a strong man who would be in a bridge position with perhaps a bunch of people sitting on his chest and on his legs.
Yeah.
That was a very popular feat of strength.
Well, even now, I know Brett Contreras has some stuff with basically doing a bridge-type lift where you're backseated on the ground or up against the bench or, you know, for more experienced people, up against your neck. And that's just an extension of those lifts that used to be very commonplace.
You know, if I had to make a really broad statement pertaining to the difference between the majority of lifters now and the great lifters of the past, the lifters of today have bigger chests, bigger arms, bigger legs, as far as bigger quads, and they have and the lifters of the past had stronger shoulders, stronger backs, and stronger hands.
Yeah.
I think the lifters of today
probably too.
Yeah. I think they look better today, and I think they perform shittier nowadays.
Yeah. Kind of ironic.
It's interesting. You look at a guy like Arthur Saxon. Saxon was one of the very best lifters of the day. He was a great wrestler, great athlete, incredibly strong. Saxon had 16.5-inch arms, a 48-inch chest, and then a six-pack with what would be considered fairly scrawny legs. Pretty skinny legs, and yet
yeah.
He could lift 350 pounds in one hand. He could pinch lift on his. He had a big ass log that is estimated to be about 180 pounds that he could pinch lift and snatch.
Wow!
He did a feat where he would have a board, a large plank placed across his legs in almost like a leg press position, and he would hold up to 2,000 pounds on his feet. And he'd go to these wrestling matches and wrestle for several hours at a time. If Arthur Saxon was in the gym today, you would not think too much of him, unless
yeah.
you saw him actually lifting.
Yeah.
And by the same token, I look at lifters today, and they're only impressive to me until they start lifting. And then it's like, that's all you do.
Yeah.
I weigh 209 pounds, probably 16.75-inch arms, 50-inch. What am I at? Probably 52-inch shoulders, 49-inch chest. Not the biggest guy you've ever seen until I start lifting, and then it changes the game quite a bit. With most of the things I do, particularly grip and steel bending, there's not too many guys that can do the majority of things I do, and I don't know anybody who, with the same body weight or age, can do what I do in its entirety. And every person out there, in my opinion, could develop that same statement. They could be the most impressive person in whatever things they choose to do. But what they got to start doing is they got to start training in a way. If you want to have an unusually high amount of strength, you probably need to do some unusual exercises.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing, too, is just people need to pick a goal. You know, it's like you go to most gyms and you would pull people and you go, well, what's your goal? I want to get a little bigger. Okay, that's cool. Well, how do you define bigger? Do you actually have measurements taken? How do you equate to that? Or, I want to lift more. Okay, that's cool. Well, how much more? On what lift? That I think even with most people are just kind of wandering, thinking that, oh, it'll just sort of kind of happen. I'm just going to do some more bicep curls. So they seem to be a little bit lost in terms of what actually it is that they want to achieve and what it is. So,
the other thing, a lot of people have got kind of some strange belief systems. One of the ones that I hear from guys is they say, I'm not really interested in getting stronger. I just want to be bigger. And my question for out there is, what makes you think getting stronger would prevent you from getting bigger?
Yeah.
Now, obviously, you can develop some pretty unusual strength and not look as big, but for most of you out there, pursuing more strength is going to make you bigger.
Yeah.
And then other people say, I don't want to get bigger, I just want to get stronger. Well, at the same token, it's unlikely you're going to be able to only get stronger and not get bigger. One of the most entertaining things to me that's come about kind of from Pavel's influence in the Dragon Door community is this legion of 140-pound guys who thinks that their thighs are too big, which is epically hilarious. So you got these guys that are afraid to lift because they think they're going to get bigger. Well, you're not going to be able to get stronger unless you get a little bit bigger. That's going to happen. But you're not going to out-squat Kurt Kowalski unless you get some bigger legs. And you're not going to outlift Donnie Thompson if you don't get some bigger back.
Yeah.
What you just said is really profound, too, because specialization in one direction is going to get you guys a lot farther than random shots in the dark all over the damn place.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was the biggest mistake I made when I was training. I had no friggin' idea what the hell I was doing. Two, I kept destroying myself in the gym, like, literally. And then three, it was like I had no specific goal and it had no timeline at all. So even now, I mean, the only real reason I ever compete is just because it has a timeline and a definitive goal and it's highly objective. You either did better on that day or you didn't. You can't argue with that. And if you didn't, well, go figure out what happened.
Competition is critical. Here's the deal, guys. You don't have to go out. In order to compete, you don't have to go out and do a powerlifting meet. All right?
No.
And you don't have to do a bodybuilding contest or something. Here's how we can define competition. Take two men and say that one of you has to do better than the other one, and you just started a competition.
Yep.
There we go. Hey, you and your buddy are going to have a competition to see who can curl the most amount of weight by the 31st of December.
I used to do that all the time.
Oh, and look at what it gave the world.
Yeah.
Arnold, you could easily say, built the best physique in bodybuilding. And if you read back on his dialogue and his memoir, they treated every day in the gym as a bit of a competition.
Yep.
And there's a lot to be said about that. I'm talking primarily about the mental aspect of it, not necessarily the physical.
Right.
Every day he came out and it was either he had bested himself and someone else or he didn't. And it doesn't matter necessarily if you win or lose, but at least being in that competition mindset, you have something to aim for.
Yeah.
It'd be like, the Van Wilder college example of a guy who just goes to college with no plan. You could be in college for a long time.
I know that.
So I try with everything that I do to have some type of timeline that I'm shooting for. Everything, fat loss, hypertrophy, numbers that I want to hit on a bar, number of repetitions, whatever it is, I always try to have a timeline, and most of the time I'm able to meet or exceed that timeline. Very rarely do I miss. the only time in my training that I ever feel like I'm floundering in a given area is when I'm unable to establish what I want to do with it.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't do pull-ups for quite a long time. And there's a lot of reasons why I didn't do pull-ups. One of them probably being that I already do so much pulling through my one-hand lifting that it didn't seem like it'd be that good of an idea until I asked myself one day, well, you know, what would it be like if you could do a pull-up with body weight? What would it be like if you could do, like, 20 bodyweight pull-ups? And there's nothing magical about either one of those numbers. Nobody else in the world is going to give a shit if I can do 20 pull-ups or pull up a bodyweight. No one cares. But at least it gave me something to shoot for, so now I do pull-ups quite routinely. And the other thing, and this is a big thing, it feels good to get your goals.
Oh, yeah.
It feels good to say, I'm going to do X, and then you go out and you do X. And it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks about it. You know, I own a world record in a lift that is fairly obscure. I've lifted more weight than has ever been documented lifting in it. And it, you know, most people, if they tell me, yeah, I can crush on the 2-inch vertical bar, they have no idea what that means. But what it means to me is that I've worked in, it doesn't matter why, I can lift the most weight on it. So that makes me feel happy inside. There's my gold sun sticker for the day.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I've even literally changed my training recently just to look and go, well, what do I actually want to get better at? And it's usually too many things. So it's usually like, all right, I'm going to take this period of time, 4 to 8 weeks or whatever, and I'm going to really work on this, this, and this. You know, so it's kind of like you have your overall goals for the year, and then, I think Zercher squats are going to help increase my squat and my deadlift. So I'm going to work and try to get really good at Zercher squats for 8 weeks and see what happens. You know, instead of trying to pick like 15 goals that you're trying to get to all the time, you know, just pick a couple or even one main one and then just kind of go from there and, you know, go for it. And even if you completely miss, you've probably still made more progress by doing that than just kind of going in and going, Monday must be bench day again.
You know, Mike, I'm gonna take an opportunity here to shamelessly plug one of our key principles that we're working towards of gym movement. You know, for everyone out there, one of the things that we would like to see more people do is what we call aligning the psychology with your biology.
Yeah.
And what that means is this: instead of playing this game where anybody can do anything they want, let's be a little bit more realistic, and we'll take a look at your body, your structure, and what your actual potential's in, and see if we could line up your fitness goals with it. So I'm going to give you a couple examples. I'm going to pick on myself, and I'm going to pick on Mike. With me, I cannot do an overhead squat. I cannot do it. I've got a bone in my spine that doesn't move anymore because it was crushing an accident a couple years ago, and it causes me some unique movement restrictions. And I have done the corrective exercises with the best corrective specialists in the world, and they managed to equal zero improvement in that one area. So that is one thing. It just will not go. I get in that position, and it's like zero improvement for me. So what that means is there's a lot of things I can do, but one thing I'll probably never be particularly good at would be an Olympic lifter. Because one of the competition events for the snatch is you pretty much have to go catch that bar at the bottom of an overhead squat and stand up.
Yeah.
So I can either try to be the square peg and jam myself in a round hole and either break the peg or round the hole, or break the hole, excuse me. Or I can look at it and say, for some reason, I have an unusually high strength-to-weight ratio, particularly related to my grip, and I can pursue grip sport. For Mike does not have stereo vision. Mike doesn't see in 3D. So Mike could go out and try to play handball or lacrosse or basketball and always be the guy who feels like he's having to play catch-up, or he can do what he does now, and he can do powerlifting, which does not involve him having to visually track an object in motion. So for those of you out there, you know, if you weigh 230 pounds and you're 6'4", gymnastics might not be the right direction for you. You might be built to go out and flip some heavy tires and pick up stones. And if you're 5'6" and you weigh 140 pounds, you know, heavy events and strongman may not be your best bet. And I'm not saying you can't go out there and be good, and that's why they have weight classes, but I would imagine you'd be much happier if you were chasing a goal that's going to give you faster results. You know, very American thought process of the I want it now. But the reality is this, if you do want it now, instead of me trying to talk you out of that mentality, I would rather just give you something where you're going to get your results much faster.
Oh, yeah, no, I totally agree with that. You know, it's one thing to try to be better than where you're at currently, and it's another thing to also be completely realistic with, you know, your structure and what you have and the time frame that you have to work with it, you know, to say, well, you know, I'm going to do this. Yeah, I may not ever be the best in the world, but I enjoy it, so I'm going to get better at it. That's cool, you know, but it's, like you said, it's completely different to go, well, I want to be a world-class, or in my case, I want to be a world-class baseball player. Well, I can't see objects that move very fast. And this probably is going to be a very hard road and probably not the best place to go for in terms of if I want to be the best in the world at it. So, yeah, I agree with what you're saying.
You know, if I'll use Hanegarney as an example. Mike and I have a friend, Josh Hanegarney, and he's 6'8". He's 250 pounds. So at 6'8", I want you to try to imagine the mechanics of the human spine trying to lift the barbell off the ground. And let's make something very clear. The height of a set of 45-pound plates was not determined by a biomechanics expert as optimal height for a person to dip down and pick up weight off the floor. So the fact that deadlift starts where it's at in competition has nothing to do with biomechanics and everything to do with manufacturing standards from like 50 years ago.
Yeah.
So, you know, a guy Josh's height has a hell of a time picking up a weight off the ground when it's heavy. So Josh breaking 500 pounds was a very substantial achievement for him, despite the fact that it was, you know, it was a half body weight, a double body weight pull.
Yeah.
And then we have got a guy like Dylan Ave who's built to pull. Dylan Ave will pick up 700 pounds before he's 30. There's no two ways about it.
Oh, yeah.
Because of his height, structure built to pull.
Shorter femurs and arm length and stuff, yeah.
So what we're saying there is that, number one, not all men are created equally, and number two, not all sports are designed with all body types in. And every sport has done its best to try to be as fair across the board as they can, but there's no coincidence that when you look at the best of every sport, they all are kind of built the same. You know, you look at the NBA. Most basketball players in a given position are roughly the same size. In powerlifting, in every weight class, in that particular weight class, all the guys more or less are built the same. It's very rare that
high level
who sits at the high level competition who's structurally dramatically different than everyone else in his weight class. And we see the example over and over and over. You know, like kettlebell lifting, it's a sport I have an interest in. And most of the high level guys that are in the 9,500 kilo weight class are all about 6'2", 6'3", with that same lanky ass build because we have better lifting mechanics for the particular competition feat. So what I think a lot of people would be happy with, and this has kind of diverted a bit from where we started, but I do think it's an important thing to hit on, is instead of please everyone else, pick a sport that is going to be suited more for your body and chase it that way, and I think you'll get there a lot farther. You'll do much, much better.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that, and the caveat I would add to that is that do something you actually enjoy, too. You know, it's like even if you're not, like I like playing volleyball, I love playing volleyball. I've actually gotten better at, you know, tracking a ball in motion and all that kind of stuff. But I also realize that if I want to get better at it, I need to, you know, fix my vision. But I enjoy it, so I'm still going to keep playing at the same level. I don't expect I'm going to be a world-class competitive volleyball player in the next couple of years. You know, so it's...
You do have the height for them.
I do have a height. That is true. So people will pick me on their team until they actually see me play. But
you guys probably don't realize how tall Mike Nelson is from the videos because he's usually by himself. But Mike is about 2.5 inches taller than me. Mike's quite large.
Yeah, so I'm like a 6'3.5". How tall are you?
Oh, you're taller than me. So I must. I always like to think I'm 6'3", but maybe I'm 6'1". In my mind, I'm like 5". Man, I'm a big guy. 5'5". You know, one more thing I want to hit on that I think is relevant too. Okay, one of the things with the old timers that I really liked was they always were getting better. If you look back at their development, you know, most of the guys had become famous in their day in their late 20s, and part of that was because with gyms not being readily available to the population, and then physical culture and true weightlifting not even being on the table for most people, your average American or your average European was kind of stuck in what their physique looked like. Basically, if you did a given job, you looked like a man or woman who did that job. So if you were a blacksmith, you were built like a blacksmith. If you were a barber, you were built like a barber, so on and so forth. It wasn't like today where the guy who works at the Gap might also be an aspiring bodybuilder and he's super yoked up. Or how your accountant might also be a state record holder in powerlifting. So those guys had an easier time getting noticed early on. But what you see is a trend throughout their life of performance. You know, Larry Scott, how old is Larry now?
Oh, man.
Nearly 80?
I don't know, to be honest. Maybe.
I hope I look as good as Larry.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
have you seen photos of Bill Pearl recently? Holy crap.
Yeah, incredible. They never really burned out. Nowadays, it's where, you know, most guys start training at 14 or 15, maybe 16, and they, you know, typically it comes in one of two ways. Okay, they either played a sport in high school, they wrestled, they played baseball, they played football, whatever. They went to college, and then they went one of two ways. They either gained weight because they drank their ass off and chased girls, or they did somewhat fix their fitness program. In their early 20s, most guys are most likely to keep hitting the gym then, and then there's a stagnation period from probably 24 to mid-30, which correlates most of the time with them finding a girlfriend, getting married, and thinking that it doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah.
They wake up one day, and they got a pot belly, and they move like shit, and they're weak, and they decide they're going to get back in the gym. Then they'll train for maybe 6 to 10 more years, and they either get burned out from accumulated injuries, or they hang it up and decide that they're a hard gainer.
Yeah.
And man, it doesn't have to be that way. If people would work within their limits, not be out there trying to kick their own ass every single day, and not do things that are getting them hurt, your lifting career is by my definition your life.
Yeah.
And when we look at these guys, don't look at the bodybuilders now. I'm not talking about the guys who are juicing it for 30 years because they have kind of a hard way out the door. But for most of the guys who are true physical culturists, most of them have an extremely active life all the way up until the end. And those guys seem to be, based on what we're seeing, as kind of that golden age of physical culturists as they're kind of all going out the door, is a lot of them go kind of fast and less painful than the decay of 10 years or something. You know, I've had to watch family members of mine pass. All the people in my family live very, very long, almost all of them into their 90s. But unfortunately, a lot of them never really did anything after they hit 60. And their last 30 years, I mean, man, it doesn't seem to be a very, very good life to me when it's a continuing breakdown over and over and over. And I look at it as, if they would have had a physical practice that was scalable, that they could maintain, many of them would have been extremely active all the way up until the very end. And isn't that what we all want? I mean, provided saying that everyone has an option here to choose, you can choose to be very active or you can choose to die off slowly. Which one do you want? I'll take very active till the end.
Definitely. No, I agree. The more I learn about physiology is the more that, you know, exercise and good movement just in general will fix virtually everything, you know, and it's unfortunately even worse once exercise and good movement is removed from the equation. Everything else just goes to hell so much faster. You know, the body is designed to move and to be, you know, challenged in the right way, and it adapts to that, and you start removing that, whether you look at studies on bed rest or even, you know, zero gravity where they've launched people into space, and man, it just goes reverse so fast. because the stimulus has been completely removed then. So,
you know, everyone, I think everyone who's going to hear this call has either owned a dog or a cat during their life.
Yeah.
If you own a dog or you own a cat, you know that you're going to lose your pet pretty soon when that pet quits moving around.
Yep.
When your dog starts sleeping for 20-plus hours a day and it doesn't want to play anymore and it's very lethargic, you know that your dog's days are really, really numbered. And so with that being said, that all of us have seen that in our life at some point, why is it that so many people in the world agree to subject themselves to the exact same thing? You know, it's a very sad statistic that most people, particularly as we're really, I mean, we're done with the industrial age completely, but kind of those final people who are retiring out of it right now, this year, 2010, it's a very sad thing, but most of these men hit 63, 64, they retire, and they're done within 2 years. They pass as soon as they're done working. You know,
yeah.
I know some guys that they would get up at 5 a.m. every day. They'd go to work at 6:30. They'd work till 7 o'clock at night. And these were not easy jobs. And they would come home and then work in the yard or work in the farm or spend time with their family and, you know, working 5-6 days a week. And on the weekends, they're incredibly active. They retire, and then it's like they burn out. You know, now that there's nothing to do, then there's nothing left to do. So...
Yeah.
What we're saying is you can reset, you can kind of hold the Grim Reaper at bay quite a bit and enjoy a much more full life as you exercise. And that's another lesson of the old timers is, you know, man,
yeah,
most
a lot of guys are still around and very active.
Our modern athletes do not age very gracefully. Look at the NFL. You know, here's the life cycle of a quarterback. Play 10 seasons, maybe 15 if you're good. Retire, do a Campbell's Soup commercial, do a Wheaties commercial, nail a job to become an announcer on one of the football shows, and then we watch you get a fatter ass every season.
Oh, yeah.
What the hell is that, guys? You spent 15 years of your life being an elite world-class athlete, you know, in the NFL, and then the season after you're done, you put on all this weight. It's incredible to me.
Yeah, and you look at the exceptions to that, like, say, Herschel Walker or other people that have kept up their exercise routine after they've, you know, left, and even with all the accumulated trauma that they've had over the years, they are still pretty good.
You know, and that really comes down to kind of managing expectations. You know, some of you out there, you're listening, you're in your 40s, you may be in your 50s, and you're saying, oh, I don't care what these guys are saying, these guys are young. Hey, I'm not saying that I expect you or I have some kind of measuring stick I'm holding up to you. I'm saying that if you're not in the gym deadlifting 500 pounds and squatting 500 pounds a week, what I'm saying is if you're not in the gym squatting something and deadlifting something, you're shortchanging yourself. There's a couple of guys that I've worked with closely, And one of my frustrations in dealing with them is they want to use their age like a crutch, and they want to tell me how, well, you know, Adam, I'm 50, and I'm not interested in being strong. Well, okay, are you interested in having a back injury for the rest of your days? Are you interested in a hip replacement? Are you interested in having to go to assisted living because you're not physically strong enough to take care of your day-to-day duties and dress yourself? Because I know this, is that when we see someone who's in very, very good shape, the end of the line looks a lot better than those who are not.
Oh, yeah.
And I hope, Mike, that 50 years from now, you're there to fucking remind me to keep going. I can't imagine stop. I can't imagine what would make me stop. Even if the only thing I could do was squeeze grippers and curl a 10-pound dumbbell, I'd still do it.
Yeah. Well, I think in the interview with Bill Pearl I was listening to, and he's got a little shed. I'm pretty sure it's him, you know, behind his house. You know, him and his wife get up every morning, goes to exercise, you know, 6-7 days a week. And they asked him, they're like, well, you know, why are you doing this? You know, and he's like, well, he's like, I enjoy it. And he's like, that's something I've done all my life. And he's like, I feel like it's my responsibility to take care of myself. He's like, it's my responsibility to be healthy and active so that I can take care of myself as I age and that I'm not dependent upon others, you know, because I didn't do what I was supposed to do, you know, which I thought that was pretty cool.
I recall, wasn't that in one of Marty Gallagher's newsletters that Marty had spent some time here in 2010 where he went out to Oregon to train with him?
And yeah, it might have been, too.
Marty was saying, too, that not only is he working, but his workouts would actually kick the shit out of most guys that are...
Yeah.
I mean, he's not out there lifting like a Nancy. He's out there training.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Pretty cool. So if we wrap up the little the summary that you'd want the three takeaways to people to take away from this call, what would they be?
Okay, the first takeaway I'd like people to do is include more standing unilateral movements, so single arm, single leg movements, primarily picking weight up and putting weight overhead. So deadlifting, cleaning, rowing, snatching, pressing, push pressing, jerking, putting weight overhead. That's the very first takeaway, is that is going to be a big change for you. Don't go out there tomorrow if you've never done it before and try to snatch a 150-pound dumbbell. Hey, start
easy.
It doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. It's only, you know, don't get crazy with it, but there's a lot of good to be done there. The second thing is to include more variety in your training. Part of it being it's going to increase your adaptability. It's going to give you a greater sum of your fitness results. The other thing it's going to allow you to do, it's going to allow you to find out what you're truly good at. You're not going to find out what you're good at just going to the gym and running through the Cybex circle. So
yeah.
You may find out that you are quite badass squatting, or you're very, very badass running obstacle courses or lifting kettlebells, whatever it may be. But do that variety, and once you find out what you're really skilled at, pursue that. Play your strength. The third thing is that adopting a fitness practice that you can do from now to the end of your days. So if your current fitness practice is something that you know you can only maintain for a couple of years, enjoy it, but understand you're going to pay a price and be prepared to change gears hopefully before you're broke.
Yeah.
So, you know, there probably are some guys who could powerlift for 20 or 30 years. There haven't been very many. There probably are some guys who could handle doing CrossFit for more than 3 weeks. There doesn't seem to be that many. I had to do it. I had to say it. I couldn't stop it. But you got to find a physical practice that is scalable, that is going to be enjoyable, that you can do throughout the duration of your life, because I think that really is what physical culture is it's movement throughout your life in a way that you find rewarding and the appropriate amount of challenge that keeps you engaged in it. It can't be too easy, you're not going to like it, and it can't be too hard, or it's going to break you. But finding that middle ground, wherever it is for every person, that's what's going to make your life more enjoyable.
Yeah, that's almost sort of the definition of flow, you know, is that trying to do something that's a little bit more difficult, but still within your limits, but not too easy. You know, finding that, and I'm sure everyone on this call has had that, where you go to the gym and you did a good session, you leave, you don't feel like you got run over by a truck, but everything just went real well, all your lifts went up, it felt, you know, relatively easy, but you still had to put a, you know, fair amount of effort into it, but it was still definitely within your realm of what you can do. And I think, to me, those are always sort of like the best, you know, sessions. I do a lot of kiteboarding, you know, so going out and being able to ride for, you know, 4 hours where, you know, the time just disappears. You're concentrating, but you're working within your limits. You're not getting, you know, thrown all over the lake or whatever, and you're leaving your training session dragging your back leg. You know, you're leaving feeling like, oh, that was good. You know, and those are, I think, the kind of days that make you want to go back and try to recreate that on a daily basis.
If I could say that, you know, and I think that's it right there, Mike, if I could define what is a perfect workout, it's the one that everything goes good and it leaves you feeling better than when you started.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I don't think the perfect workout involves any particular tool. I don't think it involves any particular set of exercises. I don't even know if it encapsulates a specific goal. I think it might be more on the way it leaves you feeling at the end. Because I know that if I can make you feel good today, I can probably have you come back tomorrow. And if I can have you come back tomorrow and leave feeling good, then I can probably get you to come back again. And pretty soon, I've got a pattern to where Even if you wanted to quit, you won't do it. And then that's where we get that lifetime fitness benefit.
Yeah, and I think in the literature they said that, I could be wrong on this, but I think someone to be considered what they call a lifetime exerciser, I think, and I could be wrong on this, they had to do it consistently, I believe, for 5 years. It was either 2 to 5 years.
That's not really that long.
Right, if you think about it, if you're going to, you know, lift and train for most of your life, even if it's 5 years, it's really not that bad. You know, so if you can invest, you know, 5 years of your life doing it relatively consistently, which, you know, some younger people listening on the call are like going, oh my God! But, you know, considering the course of your life, that's really not that much amount of time. Most people spend that long in college. Most people, not me. But
I've got a quick worry about the power of that too, Mike. So my uncle Joe Glass was on the Junior Olympics team for wrestling for both Greco and freestyle. So from the time he was 13 to 18, he had been to 40 different countries wrestling. He's got an entire box full of medals, and there's not too many bronzes in there. They're almost all golds and silvers. He was in Iraq the week before all the hostage shit went down. He'd been all over Germany. There's just so many newspaper ads that our family has with him. And when he hit 19, his pancreas completely shut down. His body completely quit producing insulin. And his life has been very, very hard since then. He's in his 50s now. Now, in my opinion, the only reason he's still alive today was because of the physical condition he was in as a young man. At 18, at 150 pounds, he was bench pressing 300 pounds. He could run for 30 miles. He would go to wrestling tournaments where he would do a Greco match, walk off the mat to a freestyle match, walk off the mat back to a Greco. In fact, he went to 15 different tournaments in 2 years where he took the gold medal for both Greco and freestyle in the same day.
Wow.
And documented shit that's in my family's history. So the point is, that was basically his 5 years of exercise, 13 to 18, which carried over to him surviving something that would kill most people. You know, he never had to have a limb amputated. He didn't have to have nearly as many surgeries as people who have had the same series of disorders. And, you know, I would be interested to see what would happen to people if they were in a productive exercise regime for 5 years, what it does the rest of their life. And then imagine if they actually continue.
Yeah.
You know, I don't see 5 years as a very long time when we talk about the health investment that you get out of it, provided that it's all doing things the right way, not you who go out there and you're breaking yourself.
Yeah.
Like, I haven't gone 5 weeks without exercising in the last 10 years, and I can't imagine a circumstance, considering how much time I've spent deployed when I was in the military, I was able to train nearly every day. There's not too many things I can think of that come up in my life besides maybe a crippling injury that would stop me from training for any length of time. It seems impossible to me.
Yeah, I mean, I'm at the same point. I'm sure other people listening are that, too. I mean, you know, it was about 5 years ago, I completely ripped my ankle snowboarding. So it was my right ankle, so I couldn't drive and everything. And I had a guy drop me off at the gym. I took a cab a couple times, and you know, you're walking around on crutches. I'm like, well, I can still do upper body stuff, you know? And so, like, and people are like, well, why don't you just, you know, just don't train for a couple of weeks? I'm like, what, are you crazy? You know, it's like the thought of not training is just like, ugh, that's just not, like, not an option. You know, I mean, I've gotten here lately and a couple of weeks ago and lifted after being awake for 38 hours in a row, you know, and it wasn't by choice, per se, and it went okay. And that's not something I'd recommend people do, but, you know, at the same point, it's like you can, if it's a high enough priority, you'll find a way to do it. You know, once you get to that point, you don't ever have to worry about, I think I'm just going to quit and never do it again. You know, it just becomes so ingrained in you that you'll just find a way to happen, you know. So.
Oh, there's a final thing on that that's worth bringing up, too. Those who have kids, all right? I hear guys tell me, I'd like to go to the gym, I'd like to train, but my kids take all my time. So I'm going to offer a counter-argument. You want to be the dad who is the first guy to play a sport with your kid.
Yeah.
You want to be the dad who can keep up with your kid when he's a teenager, when it gets to be really fun. I'd imagine you want to be the dad who's physically active enough to enjoy and become the type of father that most children want. And it's not going to happen if you sit on your ass watching TV from 7 to 9 every night, calling that quality time.
No.
Right? With all the things you could do with your time, 30 minutes every evening is going to give you much higher payoff in your dad capacity than it would be sitting in front of the TV watching, you know, a cartoon or some kind of program with them. You know, and if as soon as your kids are 5 or 6, have them jump in with you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Hey, come on down here. You know, I went to see Ryan Pitts, who owns StrongerGrip.com, a couple of years ago, and it was so entertaining to me that, you know, Ryan's son, we're out there in the backyard throwing maces and kettlebells around, and Ryan's son is climbing on a tree and doing pull-ups off the tree, and he's sprinting around his bug, and he's just being a kid having fun.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have yet to see a kid who would not enjoy having that opportunity with their dad to be able to get into some kind of physical practice. Or a daughter. I'd imagine most daughters would be the same way. I don't know for certain. I don't have children, but that's my guess. But I know this. You're going to be a lot more valuable to your kids when you are physically active and healthy than if you get fat and broke too early.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the amount of payoffs for, this is like long-term investing, right? The amount of time you put in just the exercise compared to the amount of payoff that you get from it and, you know, multiple different array of factors is pretty good investment to me. Sometimes it just takes convincing of that to others.
That's very high payoff.
Yep. Cool. Well, hopefully people got a lot of good stuff out of there. So, briefly tour of some old exercises to do, some stuff for that they can do in the gym, and have them pick a goal and go towards that by working an area that they want to definitely be, you know, performing rather well at in terms of if they have an option to decide. And, you know, hopefully a little motivational portion there that if people aren't currently exercising, they may want to start soon, or if they are, you know, just some more motivation just to keep going. So where can people find out more information about you, Mr. Adam?
They can jump onto my website, adamcglass.com. I've been running that page for some years. There's a lot of different articles, a lot of information. You'll see information from me, from Mike Nelson, Frankie Ferris, Logan Christopher, Josh Anagarny, a lot of really good guys, a lot of stuff that will entertain you. You can check out my DVD, Grip and Rip 2.1, which will teach you how to program a file feedback, which is an organization that both Mike and I are involved with. I have a new Grip product that is coming out next month, Industrial Strength Hands, and is going to teach you a wide variety of those old-timer tactics on how to build very, very strong hands, very, very simple. It's not going to take a lot of time, and it's going to be high payoff.
Nice. And I'm Mike T. Nelson. I'm a PhD candidate in exercise physiology, University of Minnesota. I teach around here, and I also run ExtremeHumanPerformance.com. So you can go there, sign up for my newsletter, tons of cool stuff on there. Blog's been up for, oh man, over 3.5 years now. And I have a Grip and Rip for sale there too. I highly recommend it. Excellent, excellent product. So you can just go up there under the top, enter products, and you'll be able to find it there too. So, thank you very much today, Adam. Greatly appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure, Mike. Thank you for having me out.
Great. Thank you very much. Take care, guys. Cool. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Adam.
Mike, that went pretty good, dude.
I think it went pretty good. Yeah, a little randomish, you know, windy trail like usual, but it's all right, you know. Yeah.
That's what people like, man.
Yeah, I think sometimes you just get sometimes too serious. It's like, okay, wait a minute, you know. Nobody wants to hear about 14 different other studies.
Now, they like variety.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you very much, and I'll probably have this one as maybe a bonus for the Grip and Rip thing, but if you have any other ideas for it, let me know, or other ideas for the past conference calls, too, let me know.
Excellent, Mike. We'll be talking this weekend, buddy. Are you coming up?